Welcome to the Mike Fave podcast. I'm your host, Ethan Wright, joined by Mike Fave. On this podcast, we help you make sense of the online health chaos while answering your individual questions along the way. If you have any health trends, topics, or questions you'd like to see us discuss in this podcast, please leave them in the comments below and we'll make sure to get them answered on future episodes. With that said, in today's episode, we are going to discuss Dr. Chafee's interesting understanding of insulin resistance, some anti-fruit propaganda from the glucose goddess and Dr. Gundry. And our star of the day is Dr. Siwez, and we're going to get his thoughts on carbohydrates and dog poop. So make sure you stay tuned for the end of that one. But with that said, Mike, we've been getting some questions on the YouTube channel. Where have you been at? What's the hiatus?
Yeah, I have seen a couple comments on the YouTube channel where people have asked, am I still alive? where have I been? So these past, I would say like 2 to 3 months, we were in the process of trying to get a course together, a program together. And so it was figuring all that out, getting everything under control, and then trying to manage both the course and the content production started to get a little tricky. So we took a little bit of a hiatus to figure it out, but now we're back. We've gotten under control and, you know, we're ready to start putting out content on a regular basis again.
Yeah, I'm excited. You're leaving the cabin you're tucked away in Costa Rica.
No, we're definitely not leaving the cabin.
Okay, you're gonna stay in there and start making some content.
Yeah, we're just gonna stay here. No more trips, no more flights, no more new countries. We're gonna hunker down, my wife and I, and just continue to produce content. And then now with the new course, we're doing Q&A 7 days a week, so just trying to make sure that I can keep up with that and then run from there.
So why don't we get started and take a look at one of these first clips here and get your thoughts on Chafee's take on insulin resistance.
If you don't eat carbohydrates for a very long time, you don't produce a body of insulin to be ready for that next hit of carbs, right? So that's why people say that if you go keto, you actually get insulin resistance. Total garbage. It's all these studies, you know, what does the study show? They can conclude whatever they want. It doesn't actually mean it's true. What that study was is they looked at your glucose tolerance. Like they give them a can of soda and then they look at their glucose and their blood sugar and it goes way up. It's because they're insulin resistant. Well, there are other things that can actually do that besides insulin resistance. And one of them is they haven't preloaded their insulin. So in fact, they're actually more sensitive to insulin because, you know, they haven't built up this resistance. Yeah. It's just, it takes a bit of time for them to produce that insulin. Whereas if you do that for a couple of days, their body goes, okay, this idiot's eating carbs again. And so you actually start preloading insulin. Yeah. And then when you eat carbs or drink that soda, it just bam, slams it down.
If that idiot starts eating carbs again.
Yeah, there's
your body just calls you an idiot. What is this guy doing?
There's so many things in this clip that are just like, there's so many implied things in here that are just fundamentally off that it's like crazy that he's even going out and saying it just like so blatantly like that. It's like, look up what you're talking about before you go and speak about it. Because when you look inside the research, if you are on a low carbohydrate diet or a ketogenic diet or carnivore diet or something like this, when you are primarily burning fatty acids in general, like this is very clear across research, you are going to be you're going to be more insulin resistant. You're not going to be able to oxidize carbohydrates as well. You're going to have a shifted respiratory quotient. You're basically going to be in a state where you're oxidizing mainly fatty acids, and in oxidizing fatty acids drives insulin resistance. Is it pathologic insulin resistance that you would typically see with diabetes and stuff like this? Not necessarily, but there is still a state of insulin resistance that is being developed, which is why when people come out of fast or people come out of low carbohydrate eating, they have this insulin resistance. And I don't think it has necessarily much to do with this body of insulin. Like, to be fair, I haven't heard that before. I don't know.
Yeah,
where
that was the first time
from.
I heard that.
Yeah. I don't even know what that means. Like, it's just this body of insulin. It's like he talked about preloading. So I guess his assumption is that the pancreas is just, because you're not eating carbohydrates, is not making insulin in general. But I don't think that that's necessarily the case either. I think it's more of a function of primarily driving fatty acid oxidation at the cellular level, which is making you less able for that period of time. It's a normal thing to oxidize carbohydrate. And then you upregulate hormones like glucagon, which also directly drive insulin resistance on purpose. This is supposed to happen in these different states. So there's just like, I don't even know if he's like reading the papers. He just like straight up dismissing them. And it's like,
isn't there research suggesting that glucose, taking in glucose makes you more insulin sensitive?
Yes, because the more carbohydrate that you oxidize, the better you are at oxidizing carbohydrate in general. There's a difference between being metabolically impaired and being like a normal metabolic function. In the metabolically impaired state, just throwing carbohydrate in doesn't necessarily fix the metabolic impairment by itself. Although there are studies that I've talked about before where you see increasing carbohydrate percentage in the diet actually increases insulin sensitivity and the oxidation of glucose. So if you push the substrate forward more with glucose, you can actually use it better over time. But in general, if you have metabolic impairment, there's a lot of things going on with prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, fatty liver, where essentially the mitochondria is having problems oxidizing the different fuels effectively, or there's a issue with insulin signaling because of a buildup of fat inside the cell, or things are being shifted towards glycolysis. So there's a general metabolic issue going on in these states that leads to problems using both fats and also carbohydrates in general. And going on a ketogenic diet can actually improve metabolic function for people, but it's not necessarily because it's like just by itself oxidizing fats is increasing insulin sensitivity. Not having carbs is increasing insulin sensitivity. It's that when you go on the ketogenic diet, there's a variety of things that go on, including the increased satiety factors and weight loss. And it's actually difficult to parse out if a lot of the benefits of the ketogenic diet are just that it's really good at inducing weight loss for people. And then on top of that, there's the shift in diet composition, right? So you're shifting towards better options from a dietary perspective in terms of protein sources, fat sources. And then usually there's a minimization of problematic carb sources, which people tend to think, and we'll see this in a clip with the low carb doc where he's like, or even when you're talking about Dr. Gundry or the clip that we're going to talk about with the glucose goddess, like they're comparing oranges and apples to Coke or to donuts. It's like, it's not the same comparison. They're not the same thing. They're not even close to the same thing. It's literally, it doesn't even make sense to compare them as the same thing in terms of their effects on physiology. And we'll talk about studies with this. So it's going keto can lead to massive weight loss. And then the weight loss itself can lead to changes in metabolic function directly. And even in the studies, just losing weight, whether you're doing keto or you're not doing keto, you're just adjusting the diet in general for weight loss. You see improvements in insulin sensitivity. You see improvements in fasting glucose in type 2 diabetics, in pre-diabetics, in people who have obesity, impaired glucose tolerance, et cetera. So keto does have this benefit for people if it's done effectively compared to what they're doing and they lose a bunch of weight. And also that you make sure they don't lose a bunch of muscle tissue, but that doesn't mean that driving fatty acid oxidation doesn't drive insulin resistance, because it does. And the more, if you have a very low carbohydrate intake and you're oxidizing primarily fats, even as a healthy person in general, you are going to be more insulin resistant as a rule. That is how this stuff kind of works. So I don't know if he hasn't read the papers or he doesn't get it, but I don't know what the deal is.
Yeah. And I think, like you see with a lot of your clients too, that there may be that initial phase where someone removes carbohydrates and all the problematic foods and the metabolic numbers do improve, right? But if you stay on that sort of restricted diet for a while, the fasting insulin and blood glucose will start to creep up, right? And that's glucagon that's responsible for that, or the stress hormones?
Yeah. So basically, let's put a timeline together. So say you have somebody who's obese, who's type 2 diabetic, and say they go keto and they lose a bunch of weight and then all their metabolic markers improve. That happens. Legit happens. I've seen it happen. Like, I've experienced it myself. When I went keto, I lost a ton of weight very quickly. Also, the other thing too about keto is, like, the first week you're going to probably lose water weight, period. So that could, depending on your size, 5 to 10 pounds. And then people see that and like that motivates them to stay on the diet. And that is something that's also mentioned in the research as a reason that people stay with this. So you're going to see a water weight initially, and then people do actually lose weight on ketogenic diets. And it is relatively comparable to other diets that are adjusted for energy intake. So if you have a higher carb, lower fat diet, they're somewhat or relatively comparable in terms of their rate of weight loss. It's not a massive difference between them. So whether you're doing low carb or high carb, you'll still see that weight loss. And the weight loss in general, particularly body fat loss, is going to drive improvements across all metabolic parameters, period. So you can use keto to do it. You could use a higher carb intake to do it. Like, it's more about managing your overall energy intake and the dietary structure. We can talk, we'll get into that later in this episode on what to do there. So you lose all this weight. Now you're leaner now. Your metabolic function is drastically improved. And say you stay on this keto, this low carb stuff. And then what starts to happen over time, what a lot of people experience, at least not everyone, but a lot of people, especially a lot of people that I've worked with personally, is their fasting blood glucose starts to rise. So now they're sitting at like 105, 110. And then even people who were type 2 diabetics, they start to see, ooh, my fasting glucose is coming up. My A1C is starting to creep back up again. And even though like my weight is good, and then also if I have any carbohydrates now, my blood glucose values jump. And that's, again, when you are running this lower carbohydrate diet, number one, insulin signaling super low. You're running on a lot of fatty acids, and the fatty acids is like the major fuel source for a lot of the cells of the body at this point, because there's no carbohydrate coming in. And if you're ketogenic, your carb intake is so low that your body's producing ketones to make up for some of that difference for the central nervous system, and on top of running gluconeogenesis. So then you also have this elevated glucagon levels, or you can have adjustments in the metabolism of glucagon and also changes in growth hormone, adrenaline, cortisol, stuff like this, lowering of thyroid function. And those things will drive the fatty acid oxidation. They're doing that on purpose. And so that leads you to a state where you're not as good at managing carbohydrates in general. So you started with metabolic dysfunction, went on keto, lost a bunch of weight, things improved. And as you continue with the keto situation, that doesn't necessarily continue to endlessly improve insulin sensitivity. If anything, if you're lean and healthy and you're on a keto diet, your insulin sensitivity is likely going to be worse overall. Now, the thing that trips people up is they go and get their labs done, like, oh, my hemoglobin A1C is better. It's like, yes, if you're looking at a 90-day average of your blood glucose values, which is what a hemoglobin A1C is to a large extent, and then also flux, it's also a measure of flux of metabolites through glycolysis, because that's what drives the glycation products. And you don't have carbs, and you're not going to have that flux through glycolysis. You're not going to have the ups and downs of blood glucose. And then your average blood glucose values are going to be lower, and your A1C is going to be lower. But now we're looking at a proxy marker to determine insulin sensitivity and not directly measuring what's going on with insulin sensitivity. And so that's where you have to be careful, because then you can still see fasting blood glucose start to elevate. And even though insulin's low, it's like, yeah, insulin's going to be low because you don't have any carbohydrate coming in. So you're not even getting any insulin signaling, but maybe glucagon is on the higher side because you're relying on the glucagon to maintain your blood glucose values. And that's where you're seeing those higher fasting blood glucose values, and that the glucagon itself drives insulin resistance. Again, there's a difference between a pathological insulin resistant state and in a physiologic insulin resistant state. And so in that circumstance, what winds up happening, and most times that I've seen, is the person's like, all right, well, I'm tired of this keto stuff anyway. Maybe they get to this crossroads, like, I'm either going to go carnivore or I'm going to go do this bioenergetic stuff. And then when they do carnivore, eventually it's a shift into bioenergetics. And then from there, when you first come into bioenergetics, you get into this like milk and orange juice and ice cream and whatever else. And then a lot of people don't do well with that. And you could have just taken your keto or carnivore diet and just started to add in a bit more carbs, which is basically what Paul Saladino did with his animal-based diet. Is it's keto slash carnivore. So it's like beef and eggs and beef tallow and stuff like this. Like, he still eats pretty high fat. And he just added fruit and fruit juice and then like potentially some starches and honey and stuff like this on board. And so that's basically the only shift that happened. For me, that also was way back in 2018 or 2016 or so, somewhere in that time frame. That's what worked the best for me as well. Although my fat intake is probably quite a bit lower than Paul's. Like, I think in some videos, like,
Paul's pretty high.
Yeah,
the last video I saw, he was like
100. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah. For me, it's like 100. And I know yours is like, what, like 80, 100?
80 to 100, yeah.
And then we just have like, you're just like your carbs, your fats, your energy substrate. So we're just kind of, you're just figuring out which mix is going to work better for you overall. But when you're lean and metabolic function is working well, like, you can get away with a lot of different mixes of carbs to fats. And that's why you're seeing this. Paul's at like 175, 150, 200 grams of fat. I'm at like 100. For me, I wouldn't do that well that high of a fat intake. I prefer to have more carb intake, and I feel better with that, so I shift to that. So there's also that personal perspective here.
And it probably depends on your context too. Like, if you were coming from, if you're coming into it like a pre-diabetic or diabetic state, would it be better to like modulate the fat intake maybe lower to start with to help support oxidizing glucose as you're trying to bring the carbs back on board?
Yeah, so what I try to do, that's a great question. What I try to do is I try to stepwise adjust things. So if you're coming in from low carb or carnivore, number one, carnivore is worse than keto, in my personal perspective. Because with carnivore, you just, like a lot of people, you have this really high protein intake. And then what winds up happening is you really drive gluconeogenesis with that setup, versus on a keto setup, you are producing the ketones, and then the ketones burn a little bit more like glucose, like their oxidation is a little bit closer to glucose. It's like you have fats on this side and your glucose over here, and then ketones are shifted like a little bit center closer to glucose. And you also don't have as much ammonia production and stuff like this from converting all the amino acids that you're taking in with the high protein consumption to glucose, because you're going to do that. You're going to oxidize some of it. And so fundamentally, I think that that's the keto is maybe a little bit better overall. But then again, like then there's nutrient density stuff. You're smashing fat.
Yeah. So you're saying keto is maybe slightly better than carnivore on like the spectrum of low carb diets. But it's funny, like the typical route that you would see someone take when they get into the restrictive dieting is to start with something maybe like keto, and then maybe they're experiencing some symptoms, and sort of the advocates in the space, you start to like go further and further until you wind up all the way at carnivore, which is probably like the worst out of all the restrictive diets, and probably making you like the most insulin resistant, like you're saying, because you don't have the ketones necessarily, and it's like the gluconeogenesis that's coming from all the protein and whatnot, right?
Yeah, and it's still there's pros and cons to each of the diets, because if you depending on how you do keto, then you know if your keto diet is just like I'm just going to eat tons of dairy fat and have like a minor amount of some lean muscle meat, you're probably not going to have a lot of nutrient density, and you're probably going to run a lot of micronutrient deficiencies, especially if you're doing like keto carnivore, you're not really having any plant foods or anything like this at all, then you're probably going to be in a circumstance where you're creating micronutrient deficiencies. So there's pros and cons to I think all of them, but I think fundamentally, they do make people insulin resistant in general. And then, but if you have pathologic insulin resistance from metabolic dysfunction, you will see those improve on those diets. But I think a large part of that is that people are just losing weight, improving diet quality, and then they have a way higher satiety intake because protein intake drastically increases, fat intake drastically increases, and you're basically just satiated all day long. And then you also do get higher nutrient density than I think you would see in a typical standard American diet, because if your breakfast is like 6 eggs and some butter, and then maybe you have like some beef or liver or something with that, like that's quite way more nutrient dense than a bowl of Cheerios or a bagel or something like this, where most of the nutrition in that is just from fortification, which is not really even the ideal source of those nutrition. So yeah, will you feel better doing that other option? Yes. But I still think ultimately what you'll find is, and ultimately what you'll find is that like, it's not, I don't think it's a great long-term strategy. And I don't think that carbohydrates are fundamentally the problem, which is what's implied with all this type of stuff. Like where Dr. Chafee is saying, you know, your body is calling you an idiot for having carbohydrates. It's like implying that if you have carbohydrates, you're an idiot. And it's like, I don't think that that's the case. It's even that goes hand in hand with this like carb addiction stuff that we see. You're just a carb addict. And it's like, I don't think that that's really the case. And I also, as an example, I have clients who have lost over 100 pounds eating carbohydrate, and it was more just setting up the diet appropriately for micronutrient density, for making sure they get enough protein in diet. They're not even on a super low fat diet. They're just, their total energy intake is managed, which a lot of the keto and carnivore diets can tend to lead to automatic caloric deficits and things like this, just because there's so much satiety. And also people are doing like OMAD or two meals a day or IF or whatever else with those diets. It's like, yeah, you're just in a huge deficit. So you're going to shred body fat off and your diet quality drastically improved. So I think there's a lot of that. And then there are some effects of ketones as well. And there are all changes in hormonal signaling. So there are things going on. It's not that I think that they don't work. I just think that there's some downsides that we have to talk about with them. And I also don't think demonizing carbohydrates is necessarily the solution either.
And your point about the carbohydrates, like how many times do you hear someone like smash a ton of donuts and then feel like terrible after? Like, oh, the sugar, like, and it's like the laundry list of things that comes like with the sugar, and they're like, yeah, it's the sugar, it's not like the fortified stuff and like whatever else is added in the seed oils and everything. It's like, that sugar really wiped me out, man. I feel terrible.
Well, that's the thing. There's a lot of, I think, conflation around what the actual cause is. And I think that even if you know people have the whole ancestral perspective, but even if you look at, like, if I was to pull up here a donut in chronometer, so let's say a cake donut or a cake donut chocolate frosted plain, so say you have one, let's say like medium donut, so it's 38, like from a, I'm gonna pull it up here on the screen and share. So if we look at one donut, one medium donut, what we see is that it's 38 grams of sugar, it's probably added sugar, but then it's 13 grams of fat. So from a caloric perspective, it's 40% fat, 55% carbs, and basically zero protein, like 5% protein. There's not really any micronutrients in it. And then the fats that are in here, I mean, they're saying it's monounsaturated, and then the saturated is only 7.6 with poly at 1.3, But if they're using soybean oil or if they're using canola oil or sunflower oil, anything like this, like that fatty acid composition is going to be different. And that's not to mention the changes, like the other things that are in the donut as far as additives go. And so you basically like, is this just sugar? Is this comparable to a glass of orange juice? Not even close. And like, we'll see that in the research. If you look at orange juice, yeah, it's just sugar from a macronutrient perspective, 24 grams of sugar. It's 87% carbs. It's saying it's 7% fat. I doubt there's even 1 gram of fat in the orange juice. The micronutrient profile is better. There's not really a high amount of omega sixes. You get a much better potassium intake. You get vitamin C. It's not, you know, one glass is not massively better, but the vitamins and minerals that you're getting in the donut, like iron or folate or any of the B vitamins here, these are fortified stuff. This is fortified stuff. So it's not even like, you know, it's not even the naturally occurring vitamins that you're seeing with, okay, you get a 20% folate on the glass of OJ, almost 185% of your vitamin C, and then almost 15% of your potassium, 10% of your copper. Then that's not to mention all the polyphenolic compounds that are coming with this as well. So it's a massive difference. There's way more components. And also the OJ is not coming with, any of the crappy additives that you would see inside the donut and industrial components and ultra processed components. So it's a world of a difference. And I think that just conflating it with sugar or carbs, I think is a misdirection. And I think it also like people saying like, oh, keto doesn't work or keto is this and that. It's like, I think people are also seeing benefits from that. I just don't think that you have to do that. I think that there's a, like, we can look at this middle ground and we can exist in the spot and say, we know that keto does work for people to lose weight and improve metabolic markers. But we also know that you could do it with carbohydrates in your diet. And we also know that in general, like if you're doing, whether it's animal-based or like a reasonable bioenergetic diet, or it's even like a reasonable keto diet or carnivore diet, like there's a lot of benefits to them and there's some pros and cons for each one. And then trying to figure out what's the best way to set up the diet for you and not which dietary camp do you identify with. I think that's less important. It doesn't matter. It's just like, what's going to get you your outcomes long term, so that you don't become one of the cardiovascular disease or obesity or diabetes statistics. And then also like not creating the shame for people where it's like, well, if you eat carbs, you're an addict. It's like, that's not helpful. I don't think that's helpful for people. And I also think it like creates this misdirection and creates fear for people. And by the time you, like when you're talking with somebody on a call or I'm talking with somebody on calls, by the time we're talking to them, they're like, I have no idea what to eat. Like I literally have no idea what to eat. That's because of this stuff.
Yeah. So what you're saying is there's no PubMed research showing that your body calls you an idiot when you start to eat carbohydrate?
No, I haven't seen that in the studies, but maybe it'll come in the future.
Okay. Well, let's jump in to the next clip then here.
Okay. Awesome.
Who's up next? Glucose Goddess?
Yeah, we have our Glucose Goddess is a favorite. She's
making
great.
Regular appearances on the channel, regular, on the podcast.
She's going to be
podcast.
A regular for us. Yeah. And then we have Dr. Gundry as well with some interesting thoughts here.
Okay.
So I'm going to share my screen and we'll take a look at this clip.
How dare I tell people not to have a smoothie? Oh, yeah. Because what a wonderful way
to get your fruits in. First of all, people identify some fruit with something being natural. They're like, fruit is natural, so it's good for you. The fruit that we eat today is not natural.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
Yeah. So the oranges we find today, the bananas, the strawberries, they are completely different from the ancestral pieces of fruit we might find in the past. So, for example, if you look at an ancestral banana, it's very small, it's full of seeds, it's tart, it's not sweet. The fruit we find today is not natural. However, if you want to eat something sweet, a piece of whole fruit is still the best thing to choose because whole fruit contains fiber and water. Now, the problem arises when you denature that piece of fruit.
Bingo.
Right? You smoothie it, you pulverize the fiber particles, you juice it, you remove the fiber entirely. Then you're just concentrating the sugar molecules. And it doesn't matter if those sugar molecules came from an orange or if they came from a beetroot and are in a can of Coca-Cola. To your body, it's the same molecules.
That one's great.
Oh, man.
It's just funny to me that she's like comparing, because you see in other videos, she compares like a soda to fruit, right? But then on this video in particular, she's nitpicking ancestral fruit versus fruit we have now and being like, it's not even the same. It's not even close. But she's so willing in other videos to draw the line, like, between soda and fruit as well, which is like as the same thing, trying to position it as the same thing.
Yeah, it's just... there's so much there. Like we can even look at the difference between a can of Coke. And even if you were to compare juice, like the only thing that is similar between them is that they have sugar. That's it. And it's like, does your body handle the sugar from like sucrose versus the sugar from orange juice differently? If you were to just extract out all the sugar molecules, sure, like it's still going to process it relatively similarly, but that's a completely fallacious argument. It's not even remotely logical and not even worth having a conversation about to any extreme extent, because it's like, okay, when you look at Coke, what are the additives in Coke? So you have phosphoric acid, maybe there's a bit of caffeine, you have sucrose, maybe there's the caramel color, and then maybe there's like gum arabic or something like this. I don't know if that's in Coke or Pepsi, whatever the additives are of Coke, something, some combination of this stuff. And it's like, okay, so there's not really much good things in there. Maybe a little bit of sugar and caffeine is fine. And then you have orange juice. It's like you have vitamins, you have minerals, you have polyphenols, and then you have the carbohydrate. And then the other thing too is like, fundamentally, you need to have some energy source in your diet, whether that's fats or sugars. Like those are the two options we have. So you have to have some of them in the diet. And even if you have starches, like it's the same. It's like, well, it all breaks down into glucose. It's like, it's the same thing. Like all of them are breaking down into this thing, but then the other things that are coming with them and how those molecules, how the polyphenols, for example, in the orange juice interact with the microbiome and then interact with the metabolites from the microbiome feasting on those polyphenols. And then those interacting with the liver affect how the sugar is processed. Then the vitamins and minerals in the orange juice also affect how the sugar is processed. So to draw this erroneous comparison between Coke and orange juice and say it's all the same thing is like, it's not all the same thing. It's definitively not the same thing in the research. And they show this at large. And like, so it's like, I don't know like where they come up with the claim. It's like, are you reading research about it? Are you just yep. making stuff well, up on the fly? Like, well, I'm not really sure.
We saw in your previous video on the glucose goddess, which everyone can go, I recommend everyone go check out on the Mike Babe channel, that reading the research is probably not her strong suit, to say the least.
It's just,
She's pretty good at marketing though. You got to give her that.
I mean, she does do a really good job with that.
Her website is pretty nice.
Yeah. Even with the naturalized fruit argument, it's like, name a food right now that we haven't hybridized or even an animal product that hasn't been domesticated. And then like, now we have an arbitrary definition of natural. And it's like, well, it's not natural because we've domesticated the fruit. It's like, okay, so what about wheat? What about corn? What about soy? Between hybridization, genetic modification, whatever else, like, are they now not natural? Or like, what about, you know, your dairy products? Like, we've domesticated cows to increase their meat production, if it's like different types of beef versus the dairy production, or the chickens and egg laying chickens have been domesticated, and then also breads have certain qualities. So are they unnatural now? So we can't have those. So it's like just creating an arbitrary definition, a fallacious argument. It's like, oh, we hybridized the fruit and it has more carbohydrate now, and so that implies that it must be bad. It's like that, you know, that doesn't pass the sniff test here as far as like being a logical argument on why you shouldn't have carbohydrate in your diet. And also, just because something is hybridized or an animal has been domesticated for a product, or even if you were to take some type of organism and you were to modify something about it, if there was only upside to do it, right? There was no downside. It just increased crop yields, drastically increased nutrient production and things like this. And we know for sure that there's no downside. Then why would you not do it? That's the question, is like, if that, so it's like this distinction doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Isn't that like the entire goal, right? Of like ancient civilizations and stuff, is to better farming practices and increase yield on food and nutrient density with the soil and everything like that. Now, obviously things are not really moving in a great direction in today's world. Right. But like the goal has always been to move in that way.
Well, and that's the thing, is like, the problem with today's systems and the food production stuff is that the primary incentive and goal is not health. It's profits, shelf life, production, yields, disease resistance, and stuff like this. And like, health is like, it's probably pretty low on the overall totem pole inside the market. So is it really because we're using machines to farm? Is it because we are hybridizing foods to make them more disease resistant? Is it because we're domesticating animals to get better production? Those aren't necessarily the problems. It's the problem is that like to maximize the amount of food production that we get, we're feeding animals toxic waste and then shoving them in really confined areas, and then getting like a lower quality meat, and then potentially for a period of time exposing them to different chemicals and hormones and stuff like this. And it's like, that is a problem because it causes issues for the animal's health and then for our health as well as a bystander, not necessarily just because we are trying to optimize production or domesticating an animal or hybridizing any food products or stuff like this. So that's where it's like, that's not a logical argument. That's not a base. There's no case there of, well, since the fruit is hybridized or domesticated or whatever the thing is, it's not natural anymore. So therefore we shouldn't have it. It's still very much a natural product. It's that we've just modified it, and rightfully so. Like any intelligent civilization organism is going to try to create a setup or an environment, manipulate the environment to optimize the food supply and to make sure that they have enough nutrient, which includes macronutrients like carbohydrates, on a regular basis. It's just, you don't want to do it at the expense of your health. And I don't think a good case has been made that taking your like really seed full banana that has no carbohydrates and having a regular banana has drastically sacrificed health properties for people. And I have studies here that we can go through very briefly to look at this.
Yeah. I mean, there's plenty of studies showing countless, you know, points about markers of health improving with fruit and fruit juice consumption and all and this kind of stuff. Right. So like, I don't think they're using ancestral bananas in these studies or whatever the hell.
Definitely not using ancestral bananas. And then the other thing too is this idea that the blended smoothies is such a terrible thing, right, that it makes things worse. It's like,
yeah,
that's not even true.
Yeah.
It's not even true. Like I can say that very specifically because we can look here. We have a study here. This is from 2022. Postprandial glycemic response to whole fruit versus blended fruit in healthy young adults. So they say, while increased intake of dietary fiber is known to reduce postprandial glycemic responses, it is less understood whether the disruption of dietary fiber in a blender alters the postprandial glycemic response. They said, we compared the postprandial glycemic response in 20 young, healthy college students after consuming whole fruit versus blended fruit. The fruit included, God forbid, a gala apple with the seeds removed and blackberries. We used, so then basically what they showed here is they say here, they say we use a repeated measure. So they use this statistical analysis, a two-way ANOVA with fruit treatment as within subjects, yada, yada. So glucose and maximum and glucose area under the curve. So the glucose levels and glucose curves were significantly lower in the blended fruit group compared to the whole fruit group. And 60-minute glucose was marginally significantly lower for the blended fruit compared to the whole fruit. Sex was not a significant main effect. So the like whether you're male or female didn't change it. And so basically what they're saying here is that the blended fruit, the smoothie group, actually did better, actually did significantly better in terms of their glucose area under the curve and glucose levels than the whole fruit group. So it's like, where are you getting this? Like, this took me literally 5 seconds to pull up on PubMed and find this study to support this perspective, just to see like, okay, maybe they have something there. Maybe there is a difference. And it's like, you pull this up and it's like, well, does that happen for some fruits? Does it happen for all fruits? Like, and we're really not, at least here, we're not seeing that play out. And again, this is for an apple. Then, and even as another example here, and I guess before I jump in, Ethan, I don't know if you wanted to say anything specific about it.
No, continue. It's just another case in which the glucose goddess is kind of caught red-handed here. Not really reading the studies, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to come out and say something, like, fine, like have a platform to discuss things, but at least like before you go out, be secure or like have some backup for what you're saying. Because, you know, we could sit here and say, okay, maybe some other fruits, if you blend them, have a different response versus ones that if you eat them whole. Like that's a potential case for it, if it even matters in the overarching context of things, which I think is where you're going to go.
I think there was one with Gary Brecka where he kind of got caught doing the same thing, like saying the same, if you blend the banana, it's way worse for your like glycemic index than it is if you just ate the banana whole. And then I think it was Lane Norton who did a video, just easily found that was simply not the case. It was actually the opposite again. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even here, this is another one where they just took the polyphenolic. So the study is apple and black currant polyphenol rich drinks decrease postprandial glucose, insulin, and increase response to a high carbohydrate meal in healthy men and women. So this is a clinical trial. This is a randomized controlled double blinded crossover trial. So like a pretty high quality trial. This was done in 2017. And basically what they did was they just added the polyphenolic rich extracts from apples and black currants. And they added those into meals that were either starch containing or sucrose containing. And then basically what they found is they say incremental areas under the curve for plasma glucose levels, concentrations, were lower following the apple extract and black Huron extract over 0 to 30 minutes and 0 to 120 minutes compared to controls. So the group that just got the sucrose or starches, like just purified sugars or starches, actually had worse outcomes than if you gave them the polyphenolic-rich components. Now, why is this important? Because it's like, well, you know, orange juice and Coke are the same thing. It's like orange juice is very rich in polyphenolic components. So it's like they're not the same thing. So to even like, the research is making it very clear. Like, please read the research. Like I'm telling, I'm showing the study. Like this is for glucose goddess specifically. Like the polyphenol compounds make a difference in the gas, the gut derived hormones. So they even looked at things like GIP and then GLP-1 things like this to see what their effects were, and they see that, and also looking at insulin, C-peptide, GIP. Were significantly reduced relative to control. So basically what they're showing here is that the polyphenol compounds have hormonal effects and they improve blood glucose utilization. So say you're having a whole fruit, right? And so, or say you're having a smoothie, God forbid a smoothie, or say you're having some juice, it's going to have a drastically different response than just having pure sucrose in a Coke or just having like straight up white rice or something like this. And then if we come into this next spot here, these are a meta-analysis, 100% fruit juice and measure glucose control and insulin sensitivity, a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. They say compared with the control group, 100% fruit juice had no significant effect on fasting blood glucose, fasting blood insulin, or hemoglobin A1C. Results from stratified analysis and univariate meta-regressions also largely showed no significant association between 100% fruit juice and measured glucose control. Overall findings from this meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials suggest a neutral effect of 100% fruit juice on glycemic control. These findings are consistent with findings from some observational studies suggesting that consumption of 100% fruit juice is not associated with increased risk of diabetes. So this is one, so systematic review and meta-analysis. And then here's another one here, effect of fruit on glucose control and diabetes mellitus, a meta-analysis of 19 randomized controlled trials. And they say 19 randomized controlled trials with 888 participants were included. Fruit consumption significantly decreased the fasting blood glucose concentration, but it showed no significant difference on hemoglobin A1C. Subgroup analysis further suggests that the consumption of both fresh and dried fruit decreased fasting blood glucose concentration. They say increasing fruit intake reduced fasting blood glucose concentration. Therefore, we recommend that patients with diabetes eat more fruits while ensuring their total energy intake remains unchanged. And then another one, association between fruit intake and risk of diabetes in the OSDIBE cohort. And they say, this population, 7,675 Australians, had a mean age of 54 years. Total fruit intake was inversely associated with serum insulin and HOMA-A2% beta. So it's like an indicator, a metric or an index of insulin resistance, and positively associated with HOMA-2S at baseline compared to participants with the lowest intakes. So quartile one participants with moderate fruit intake, quartile three, had 36% lower odds of having diabetes at 5 years. After adjusting for dietary and lifestyle confounders, association with 12-year outcomes were not statistically significant. So basically what we're seeing here is fruit juices, fruits, all of them, like if anything, they're at the minimum neutral and at the maximum actually having a benefit inside the research for people with diabetes, without diabetes, and with metabolic dysfunction, without metabolic dysfunction, on their ability to actually use carbohydrate. So it's like, I think we can stop at this point. With, oh, you better not have your fruit blended up in a smoothie. God forbid you have a little bit of OJ in the morning or whatever the deal is. Like, I think we can stop with that. I think it's pretty clear that at the minimum, the fruit is neutral. And at the maximum, there may be some benefits. And, you know, if you are a type 2 diabetic with blood glucose dysregulation, should you plow a quart of orange juice right now? Probably not. It probably would be better for you to do, like, you can have a smoothie, but do whole fruit blended up with like coconut water or something like this, or have whole fruits in general, or maybe you tolerate some starches better. Maybe that's sweet potatoes. Maybe that's yams. Maybe that's white potatoes, or maybe that's oats. Maybe you do a little better with a little bit of legumes or something like this than you do with, like, I'm just going to plow orange juice all day long. Like, sure, you may, that is definitely a reality, but to say that like normal people, or even people who have like mild metabolic impairment, are going to get significantly worse having fruits or smoothies, I think is like, I don't see the support for that in the research, nor have these people who are making these claims cited anything to show this. It's just these erroneous arguments around, well, it's not natural because we domesticated or hybridized it. So it's like, okay, show some outcomes in people. Like, let's see the outcomes. And then it's like, we see them.
right? And even if you like, we're using the frame of the glycemic index is only useful, right, if someone is dealing with blood sugar issues and something spikes it really high. But don't, like, is it even worth considering the initial spike if it just drops back down to baseline, like thereafter, like whether it's a banana that's blended, goes a little bit higher, and then a banana that you eat whole, but either way, they both kind of come down. Like, you're not really doing anything bad if your blood glucose goes a little bit higher, right?
I think that for when somebody is very, like, really has significant metabolic dysfunction, in the beginning, it's probably better to shift towards sources that don't give you super massive spikes. Like, if you're a type 2 diabetic, ideally you're trying to get your postprandial blood glucose spikes at least less than 150. That would be like an ideal target. And then your fasting, obviously for even normal people, fasting is less than 100, but I mean, ideally 90 or so or less, a little bit less than that. So if you can set up the diet in a way that does that, then I would shoot to do that as you're losing the weight. And as you lose weight, as you take off the body fat percentage, then you'll find a lot of times what I see with clients that they start to tolerate things that they didn't tolerate before. So maybe in the beginning, a banana, maybe not so great. If you have a whole banana, maybe you do a half a banana and you mix that with some blueberries and you put that in a shake with some water. And then on top of that, with the meal, you have maybe like you're having some eggs with that. And then, you know, something like this, like you're also combining all the things together. So there is something that the glucose goddess does get right. And it's that when you combine the protein, the carbohydrate, the fiber, and the fats together, it does improve blood glucose curves. So in that circumstance, like, yes, like have your carbs present inside the context of the meal and then have evenly spaced meals across the day. And then just try to figure out which carb sources you tolerate best and make sure that your overall energy intake and dietary setup is set up in a way that, number one, protein's high enough so you maintain your muscle mass. And then number two, that you're in enough of an energetic deficit so you could take off some of the extra body fat, because the high levels of body fat are constantly leaking inflammatory mediators and free fatty acids into the bloodstream. And that's creating this issues across all of the other tissues. Because when the muscle tissue and the livers and in the fat tissue, or it's mostly the muscle and the liver, start to get loaded up with fats, then it starts to impair their insulin signaling. You get partially oxidized fatty acid products and stuff like this. So you need to take that body fat percentage off and you need to increase the muscle mass. And then you find, oh, I'm starting to tolerate things and didn't tolerate before. I had clients who we started out like OJ was a no deal, no bueno, because blood sugars were high. It's like, okay, fine. Like, use the whole fruits instead. Make sure you're eating enough protein. We set up the diet appropriately so that they're losing weight. They lose like, you know, 10 kilos, 20 kilos, something like this, which is 20 to 40 pounds. And then what winds up happening is like, bam, all of a sudden, oh, I can do a bit of OJ here and there. I can tolerate this. I can tolerate that. My blood glucose levels are much more stable. And things drastically improve. So there's a timeline as well, because it's not just that carbs are inherently bad, but if your cells, your engine of your cells, your mitochondria, or the cell itself is not functioning appropriately, and then you inject nitrous, which is it either like just straight up like rapidly digesting carbohydrate into the system, and the system's already overloaded, the engine's already flooded, you can create problems. So you want to start with something that's a little bit easier to tolerate. On the flip side, if you're an athlete, like you're probably not going to want to load up on potatoes, because you're not going to be able to eat enough potatoes by itself to actually hit a carb target or an energy target. So there's different spectrums and there's different contexts, and that's where things become really important to know that person's context and then make decisions instead of coming out, which we'll see in a second, with the low carb doc where all carbs are terrible. It's like, okay.
Yeah, I really want to get to the low carb clip. So this is what I've been waiting for the whole podcast. But yeah, to your point too, like you're saying that it's kind of a multifaceted approach that you're taking when someone's coming with like a lot of metabolic dysfunction and maybe overweight. So you're in the caloric deficit so that you're losing the weight, but you're simultaneously structuring the diet appropriately to get the best response to blood sugar. And that's adding the fats, the fiber, the protein with the carbohydrates, and then making sure that those foods also contain like the necessary nutrients like potassium and magnesium and stuff like that to assist the glucose from being oxidized in the cell, in the mitochondria.
Exactly. Yes, okay. We're trying to make sure that, and we'll get to this because we have a question from someone in the community. So we'll talk about it in the question, but how we structure the diet to manage the blood glucose response. And then what it's a combination of diet, supplementation, movement, exercise, and looking at what's going on with hormones and things like this, like looking at all of this together to have the outcome instead of going all in on like, well, the only thing that I'm going to throw my chips on is I just don't have carbs. Instead of like, well, we have all of these modalities that we can use. It's like, you're really going to just like all, everything's on black. Like you're betting everything on black. You don't want to take like a multifaceted approach. You want to just put your chips all on, well, if I just eliminate carbs, like that's it. It's like, well, there's way more that you can do than just that.
And that's why when people are on the call with me, obviously I don't give direct health advice or anything like that, but they speak to me before they get to you and they're asking, what do I eat and all this stuff. It's like, there's so many things to consider before you decide what to, like, between the total amount of calories, the ratio of the calories, what foods to include to make up those calories is all going to be dependent on like what context you're coming from, your metabolic function, the hormonal status, like all this kind of stuff. So I think with other dietary strategies that people come from, particularly the low carb stuff, it's a very simplistic view where I just remove the challenge, which is I'm having trouble oxidizing glucose. I'm insulin resistant. So I'm just going to remove this thing and initially I'll see these improvements, right? And then that's as you go down the road, it's like, oh, keto's not working anymore. Now carnivore, until you've run out. Like the one trick that you had was remove carbohydrates. And now you're at the end of the road and things still aren't working. So you come to bioenergetics and it's like the solution isn't as simple as these previous diets that you were on beforehand, where you could just remove one, demonize one macronutrient, which is a nutrient. And then you have to find out which ones are specific. Like you have to meet yourself where you're at, whatever hole you kind of dug yourself into previously. Yep. Is going to require more discernment for what, how you choose to go forward when you come to bioenergetics. So I hear, you know, a lot of people who are just like, what carbohydrates do I eat? It's like, that's going to take some time to figure out. Like,
yeah. And so, it's personal too, right? Cause it's right. Like for both you and I, like we weren't doing well with super well with too much starches. And that was more because of like, for it's like gut related, but also like the sleepiness components was like doing better with sugars. And then as your stuff started to improve, like you do okay with a bit of starches now. And then like for me, I still don't do super well with starches. So I lean more towards the fruits and sugars. But I have other clients who are doing mostly starches and do much better with starches. And they don't do quite as well with the sugars. And like, that's fine. You have to figure out what's going to work for the individual. We can't come out here and say that there's one strategy for everybody in the sense of like that, you know, everybody's just eat this one food. It's like, we need to extract the principles for people and then help people to actually put those principles into their lives, not try to put the people into the principles and put them in this box. And well, if that box doesn't work for you, then you're just the problem. It's like, no, maybe we need to like, it's your box and we're trying to figure out how to make that work within your context and your lifestyle. There's the other thing too, that's really important is like, can you do this on a regular basis and sustainably across time? If you can't do it sustainably across time, like this is what happens. What are you going to do? You're going to go on a diet for like 2 months, lose weight, and then hop off it again and go back to where you like maybe and wind up even worse because the way you did the diet wasn't great. It's like, that's not really a great strategy, especially over the long term, especially if your goal is health. Maybe for like, you know, a cut for a wedding or the summer, like fine. But in terms of like preventing cardiovascular disease or diabetes or cancer or any of these types of stuff, like it's not really a long-term strategy to be like, yeah, I'm just going to do this for a month. And it's like, no, like we need to make sure that all of these foundational components are dialed into your context so you can maintain it over the long term sustainably in your life. Because it's going to be different person to person. And we, you know, when you start working with people, and I think this is part of the problem with some of the influencing spheres. Like if you don't actually work with clients on a regular basis, then you don't get to see just how individual things are. And then you can gauge things based on your own context. And then you like for me, like if I went out and tried to make everybody run a similar setup that I'm running for myself, like that would not work. I would fail as a practitioner because people have vastly different responses. And when I first started out, I was just helping people for free. And I started to see, oh, well, this person didn't really tolerate that. I did fine with this. And it's like, oh, so maybe there's not a one size fits all.
Yeah. And you have difference like from men and women too. And yeah. So, yeah, it's a mixed bag of things.
Yeah.
But let's jump into Dr. Siwas and Doc Loop.
Yeah, this one is probably like the worst of all the clips today.
Change your way of thinking to look at the total carbohydrate content of what you're putting in your face, whether it's a drink or a food, not whether they tell you it's healthy or not. If you've got a dog, do you eat your dog's poop? Hell no, I don't eat my dog's poop. But what happens if I sprinkle some protein, sprinkle some minerals and vitamins on your dog's poop and give it a good smell and a good taste? It's still dog poop. And I don't care how you flavor it, I'm not eating it. Well, think of sugar in that way. And an apple is just pure sugar with a little bit of protein and fiber sprinkled on it. That doesn't make it healthy. Additives do not make carbohydrates healthy.
Oh man, this is...
So an apple is just dog poop with some vitamins, minerals, and fiber sprinkled on it? Is that the comparison there?
And he literally calls it additives too. It's like...
Yeah, yeah.
They're not additives. They're naturally occurring. It's not an additive.
Yeah.
It's like a fake comparison. It's like, and what is similar between dog poop and an apple? I don't know. Like, there's like, how are we getting this? Like, it's literally, this is not even an argument. It's not even an argument. This, the level of logic that goes on here is just, it's like, I can't even say, I have nothing even to say about it. It's just ridiculous. It's just like the whole setup.
You think anyone's watching that going, oh, yeah, that's a really good point.
I don't know. Yeah. I think it just like creates a polarizing thing, and it like creates a lot of tribalism around the diets and
it's demonizing like the foods and the food groups. Like even when we watch the Chafee clip and Chafee, of course, in preparation for the podcast, I watched quite a few Chafee clips, unfortunately or fortunately. Like every single clip has that eerie, like I don't know if it's a Snoop Dogg like soundtrack in the background, where it's like you're uncovering and revealing like this new information, like carbohydrates, like insulin and this and that. It's like it just feeds into this whole like weirdness to the whole low carb, like cultish vibe.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, we already saw the studies that we see the fruit consumption doesn't have these negative effects, even in the diabetic populations. Whether that's whole fruit, which in this case it's apples, and even apple extracts have a benefit. So, you know, just like trying to create this perspective in people's minds where it's like, oh yeah, carbohydrates, even fruits, which people usually consider are healthy. It's like, oh, they're equivalent to dog poop. It's like, come on, man. Like let's actually, like, are we trying to get people better? Are we trying to make improvements in people's health? Are we trying to like, you know, get to like, I guess like smooth out paradoxes and try to understand what's going on? Are we just saying like all carbs are bad, even fruit, it's dog poop? Like, just think about it that way. It's like, I don't think it makes it easy to just be like all carbs are bad, I'm just going to avoid all carbs. But it fundamentally, like, I don't think that that's the long-term solution with this type of stuff. And I also think it's an unfair characterization of carbohydrates, and it doesn't really help us solve why people are having these problems. And I don't think it's because they're eating too many apples. Yeah, this type of stuff, I think that these analogies, these mindsets are actually in the long run creating harm for people, because what's happening is people are then, you know, if you go through a number of dietary spheres, what happens is you start with maybe low carb. Well, oh man, the carbs, like all carbs, they're dog poop. So I can't ever eat that. And then you get into carnivore. It's like, oh, plant foods, oh, they're terrible. And then you have problems in carnivore and you get put into this box mentally because you can't do all these things. You can only do these things, but the things you're doing aren't working. So it creates this place where like, well, what are my options now? And then that's where people get stuck into this. Well, you go onto the Reddit and it's like, well, add more beef tallow. You just need more fat. Like, you just need more salt. You just need to take more LMNT. Like, that's what you need. And then it's like, but then they're well, I'm already doing that. And it's like, well, I'm not getting better. And it's like, that's why I think like people, like Paul's animal based stuff was so like bothers so many people. Like, so many people are like going after Paul with this, cause he was carnivore and then he shifted. Cause it like creates this doorway for people to be like, well, maybe the carbs aren't that bad, or maybe I can actually have some plant foods that I tolerate. And it eliminates, like, that's where you get into this next step where your thinking is less horizontal in the sense of, well, it's keto, then it's carnivore or vegan or plant-based or calories in, calories out. If it fits your macros, like, just like hopping diet to diet and starting to like move into a vertical fashion and start to say, well, maybe if I thought about this a little differently, instead of saying like looking for a singular boogeyman and then going black and white on it, maybe there's like these shades of gray on the circumstance of like, well, maybe I tolerate some carbs, maybe I don't tolerate other carbs, maybe I can keep the protein and stuff that worked well for me and then add these other things in and then build out the diet from there. And then that's where I think you start to make progress. For me, that was a huge shift. I did all these diets and not one of them like solved the problem. So, but there were some things in each diet that was helpful. So then I remember one day I was like, what if I just took the things that were helpful in each one of these diets and kind of combined them together in this hodgepodge type of strategy? And then I started to, then I did that. And I was like, I'm feeling quite a bit better. And then from there, I started to try to see like, well, what are the principles that I can extract out and then create a system around it and then run that. And then I did that. And I was like, I'm able to actually manage my health pretty well here. And then you start to see like, you can apply this system to other people. You can apply these principles, not the same exact diet, but the principles, and just get to the point of what do we need to do right now to help you to get your health better? Do I feel good at this? Okay, I do. Maybe I have some stress in them, sleep's not good, and I'm not losing weight, but it's not great. So maybe bump some things up a little bit and then kind of make adjustments these fine tuning adjustments instead of like, well, this keto stuff doesn't work. So milk and orange juice and ice cream, here I come. It's like, let's just take like one step at a time and figure out what works for your context instead of this tribalism stuff.
Yeah, and even just realizing like one of this, like macronutrients are a thing too, as well as micronutrients. Like you hear people in the low carb sphere all the time talk about nutrient density, and what they're normally talking about is micronutrients, vitamins and minerals and things like this. But they're completely okay with saying this macronutrient, a carbohydrate, is not necessary, or it's like not essential, is like the argument for a lot of them too, right? And if to the diabetes and managing blood sugar and insulin resistance and metabolic function and all this kind of stuff too, wasn't there the Kepner guy who had the rice diet? Or in there you can find like papers from a long time ago where people were curing insulin resistance with like table sugar. Now I don't think the rice diet or the table sugar is probably the way to go at all, but it just does solidify the point that these things are like macronutrients, right? And so yeah,
it's basically you could find research studies seeing improvements in all types of metrics. Like you can go find papers in oats improving blood glucose values and hemoglobin A1C and stuff like this. So the question is not, does keto work or does this low fat stuff work or does the rice diet work to some extent? That's not even the question. The fundamental question is, what is the diet that you need that is effective for you, that you will use, like diet, lifestyle, supplementation regimen, whatever the thing is, that gets you your outcomes and you can sustain over the long term? I don't care about keto, carnivore, bioenergetic, Kempner, whoever, it doesn't matter. It's like, what is the actual principle and components that move the needle and is effective for that person so that they are seeing their outcomes at the end of the day? And what do I need to do to make adjustments to help them get there? You want to lose 50 pounds? What do we have to do to get that without trashing your metabolism while we maintain your lean body mass? If you want to improve your blood glucose values, what do we need to do to get there? And what are all the tools that we have? Not, well, I'm a keto advocate, so I just do keto stuff only. It's like, what is it that we actually need to do? And then also, the idea of like essential or non-essential, who cares? It's what is optimal. What is going to drive the best benefit over the long term for somebody within reason so that we can live a better life in general with our health and like live to a long term without getting these serious health problems. Like, what does that take? It's not, I can never eat this thing again. I can only eat the like most 100% grass-fed meat and the cows have to be like treated with like the utmost care. Like they get like shiatsu massages every day. Like it's like, we don't have to do all that. It's just like, let's try to figure out what's going to be reasonable for that person's context. Some people are like, look, I want to like be on all the time. It's like, okay, you want to like take it to the next level, then we can do that. So like it's person dependent, but I think most people I'm working with is like common sense stuff and applicable stuff for like an everyday average person. And how do I get the outcomes with that? And that's diet, lifestyle adjustments, some supplementation, maybe there's some stuff off with hormones, and then addressing that on the individual basis.
And with the people that I talk to, like it seems to be the route that they take to manage some sort of metabolic dysfunction or blood sugar issues is if you go to the doctor, it's GLP-1 agonist and metformin. And that's kind of like the route you're steered towards there. And then if you try to go to this alternative health perspective, you usually have to make it through low carb and restrictive dieting and intermittent fasting before you land on bioenergetics. So it's like, those are the two paths. And correct me if I'm wrong, but both of those are moving in the opposite direction of solving the root of the issue, right?
Yep.
So I mean, yeah, I mean, but like I talked to another person and they were saying, like, I added in carbohydrates when I came to bioenergetics and I feel like so much better. My energy's better and everything. But I stopped doing my blood glucose reading in the morning because it was too high and it was making me feel, you know, like bad about what I was doing, even though I'm getting all these other benefits. And what he was wondering is like, how can I include carbohydrates in my diet and get all these benefits while also improving this metric and metabolic function and all this kind of stuff? And you can, but it takes like a nuanced approach, which obviously you touched on earlier, but yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And it's, the thing is context for everybody here. So you're doing the discovery calls for us. Like when people sign up, if they want to work with me in it or, you know, join the community or whatever, they hop on a discovery call with Ethan. And then Ethan, you listen to what they have going on, like their context. And we try to figure out like would the community course, like the program work?
Is there something we feel like can help them?
Yeah. Or do you want to move towards like, do you need like more one-to-one assistance and stuff like this? So, and that's where you're talking to people. So you're getting to talk to people there and like people are asking you these questions. And so basically to answer the question that you got from the gentleman you spoke with, it's like you just need to play around, I think, with the macros set up with the diet and then the types of carbs you're using. And I think you'll find that if you get those right, you can still have carbs on board, you can still feel well, and you'll see those blood glucose numbers come down as fasting blood glucose are coming down. And if you're coming from a lower carb background or keto background or carnivore or something like this, those numbers will also come down over time. It may take like a week or 2 weeks. And also depends on what you're doing with your diet. But once you get it in right, you'll see that come down pretty quickly. I see that come down very quickly, especially in people who aren't type 2 diabetic. I see those numbers come down very fast.
Yeah. And that's a perfect segue into the question that we have from the community.
So this question comes out of the private community that we have that Ethan's a part of as well. And one of the members from the community asks, I would like to know how to use food and exercise to manage blood sugars. I tried the GLP-1 options and it really traded one problem for another. Metformin was my only RX tool. And now that bothers my gut. When I tried carnivore, my blood sugars were way better, but eating that way was not sustainable. Now I have pro-metabolic eating and exercise as my only options. My question is how to get a handle on getting my blood sugar in a healthy range, defining that healthy range, foods, timing, ratios, etc., and how exercise plays a role. So really, how can I restore my blood sugars to be normal versus high? Is it possible? So it's a great question. And we picked this specific question because it also ties with all the stuff that we were talking about, all the clips and everything we were talking about today. First question is how to get a handle on blood sugar in a healthy range, and then defining that healthy range, foods, timing, ratios, et cetera, and how exercise plays a role. So let's define the ranges first, and we'll talk about what to do. So fasting blood glucose, you want to be at least less than 100. Postprandial blood glucose, try to get it less than 150. If you're a type 2 diabetic, if you're a normal person, at least less than 140. If you don't have the metabolic dysfunction, it shouldn't be going over. Now, different foods will change that. If you smash sushi rice, like 100 grams of glucose from sushi rice, are you going to get a spike? Yeah, probably. Probably going to get a spike. Just because pure glucose, like straight glucose, like mainlining, you might as well be injecting it. If you're having it like potatoes in the context of a meal, so it's maybe some potatoes, some cooked squash or carrot, maybe a bit of blueberries on the side, and then a nice ribeye or something like this, like you're probably not going to get a super high spike very quick with those because it's going to take the protein and the fat's going to slow that gastric emptying. You're going to have satiety. Going to force you to eat a little bit slower. You're going to have the polyphenol compounds. You're going to have the vitamins and minerals. You're going to have the fiber. So all of that's going to change the blood glucose response versus like you wake up and just like smash rice very fast, like a large amount. So the foods will obviously change that. Now, speaking of which, the next question was, what's the deal with foods, timings, ratio, etc.? So we'll talk about this first. So with foods, timing, food timing and ratios, macros and calories. So first, if you have metabolic dysfunction, there's a good chance that you probably have a higher body fat percentage than you like. And also, or potentially there's a buildup of fat inside the liver. If that is the case, the goal is to lower that. So you're probably going to want to set up your total energy intake in a slight deficit, depending on where you're at, probably somewhere around 20%. And then from there, you want to get your macros right. So there's a caloric deficit around 20%. That's not a level that's going to be super stressful. And you'll see your markers improve pretty significantly as you slowly lose the weight, maybe, you know, about a half pound per week, something like this. Then you're going to get your protein right. You want protein higher. So I usually shoot 0.82 grams per pound. If you are a lean person, if you're dealing with obesity or higher body fat percentage, then I'm looking at 1 gram per pound of lean body mass. The definition cutoffs, 26% for man, if your body fat percentage is higher than 26% for a man, and women greater than 39%. Then from there, you're going to figure out your carb intake. For women, lowest threshold I go is like 120, 130 per day. Man is like 150. And that's basically the amount that your brain uses carbohydrates on a regular basis. You don't have to drive gluconeogenesis. So, and then from there, you'll have to adjust your carbs up or down, you know, or usually up based on your caloric target and also in ratio in amounts with your fat. And then fat, I usually shoot for about 25% of calories, less than about 30%. You see increases in insulin sensitivity because you're using mostly carbohydrate. So you could be 20 to 30%. I usually start at 25 and I'm just massaging carb and fat intakes to hit whatever the caloric target is. And protein is always staying the same. So that's the macros. Next thing is getting your meal stuff under control. You want to have all the components in the meal, protein, carbs, fat, fiber, the polyphenol compounds, everything in a meal. And you want to have your meals evenly spread across the day, about 3 to 4 hours apart. So that will get things situated. Then you have to figure out your food sources. Do you tolerate starches, sugars, whole fruits, tubers, oats, whatever the components is, figure out your mix, your fuel mix. You know, that's extremely important. And then construct the diet out of that. And then from there, then you can start to make sure you're covering your micronutrients with different specific foods and supplements and stuff like this. Now, I cover this all in depth, step by step. The calories and macros I talk about inside the Nutrition Blueprint on my website. And then the course that I built out covers this in depth. And I'm making videos now to cover like what lab tests to get and the, you know, how to troubleshoot different components, thyroid, female hormones, male hormones, gut stuff, et cetera. So all this is in there. And then I do Q&As every single day. So I'm walking through this inside the course as well. But this is what I'm doing in that process. I'm doing these specific components with people, helping them set it up to their specific context and then basically running from there. So that's the foods, timing, and ratios that we kind of talked about. I just went through them. And then the last one is exercise. So what am I doing with exercise? I'm having people just, if they won't lift, they're like, look, Mike, I'm not going to the gym. I'm not lifting. I'm not doing any of that stuff. Then I say, well, would you do a band workout at home? No. Okay. Can you go for a walk? I could do a walk. That's fine. I could do a walk. So then I'll have them do walks. You can walk after meals for like 10 minutes, you know, 15 minutes. It doesn't have to be like, you don't have to like power walk with a ruck on. You don't have to do anything like that. You could just go for like a normal walk. That'll help improve your blood glucose response. And the walking improves circulation. You want to get some of that activity in because sedentarism is a huge issue, as well as like, you know, ultra processed food consumption, not getting the diet stuff right in general. So walk's good. Ideally, I would say resistance training. The more muscle mass you have, the higher metabolic rate you have, the more insulin sensitivity you will have on average, and the better metabolic outcomes you will have. Your muscle, like having a higher muscle mass, extremely important. And for women, postmenopausal women, exceptionally important to maintain muscle mass and bone mass as you age. One of the number one things that's creating health problems or even death in people when they get older is falling and breaking hips and then going to the hospital getting pneumonia or C. diff or whatever the deal is. So maintaining muscle strength, muscle mass, bone loss, preventing age-related sarcopenia, which is muscle loss, extremely important. And this doesn't have to be like, I'm going to go in the gym and I'm going to power lift and like listen to metal and put my headphones on or whatever. It's just, you can go in the gym, like Planet Fitness if you want, and you don't have affiliation with the gym, like whatever gym you want, whatever YMCA, Crunch, whoever it is, LA Fitness, they have machine circuits in there. You can literally go in and just do the machine circuit. And then you have to get enough volume per muscle, like sets per muscle group per week. So it's between probably like most people are going to start on the lower side, but 6 to 10 sets per week, 6 to 12 sets per week per muscle group. So pecs, lats, biceps, triceps, quads, hamstrings, glutes, calves. Those are the major muscle groups. You're going to start doing those. Go do, make sure you're getting like 6 sets of those weeks. That's literally a workout 3 times a week for 40 minutes. Go on machines. You literally could sit down the whole workout and then rest a minute between sets. That is more than enough to have a benefit for muscle mass and insulin sensitivity, maintain bone mass as long as you're lifting to a heavy enough capacity. So these are things that I'm doing with people, setting these common sense things up. And that's what moves the needle. Multiple people lose over 100 pounds while maintaining, if not gaining lean mass, doing this diet, setting the diet up appropriately, covering micronutrients, and then lifting. And then if they have specific other issues, we get that under control. Those are the foundational core components that move the needle for people. So you get that under control and then you can maintain that over the long term. And that's really what it takes. There's a bunch of substance stuff, but those usually move the needle not as much of as this. Those are like, that's the icing, the cherry on top, the sprinkles on the ice cream. It's not the full meal beforehand. That's the sleep, the stress, the diet, the movement. Those are the most important pieces. Those are the most foundational pieces. And then you could talk about sups and then also more specifics if there's gut issues or hormonal problems, et cetera.
Yeah, I think people are normally pretty surprised. At least I was too when I was trying to solve my own issues with how much of a lever you can pull by just setting up the dietary foundation alone and what that can accomplish, especially if you're like really consistent with it.
Yep.
And whatnot. But I want to ask, so if someone comes to you like diabetic, right? And then they'd say they were doing like low carb or whatever, and they're a type 2 diabetic, like that's what their fasting blood glucose is showing. Typically, if they're implementing all these different strategies that you just laid out, what is the timeline to where they can start seeing improvements in the blood glucose? Like, what should they be expecting? Is this a 6-month process, or should they see like improvements in the first couple weeks? And give me an idea.
They're going to see improve like within the first like 1 to 2 weeks, you start to see things change. Yeah, you should see. And again, this is why I'm saying, like, when I'm working with somebody, I'm gauging an outcome. When I see, we do a first call together, like you set up the diet, we set up the diet, all this type of stuff, right? By the next week or the week after, if you've been on the diet and you've been following through and you haven't been losing 1 pound per week or a half pound per week or something like this, we're not seeing after 2 weeks that trend down and you're not feeling better, whatever the deal is, we're adjusting immediately because you should see it. You should see the weight start to come off. You should see, like, if they're having digestive issues, I minimize foods that'll be problematic. It's not even hard to implement the diet. So we make sure that it's implementable. Like, they, you know, say you have a really busy morning, then we set up a shake. It takes 5 minutes to make. You can do it the night before, put it in the fridge, blend it up when you come out in the morning, and you hit the road, go to work. So it's like, we try to remove all barriers of things that's like, oh, well, I can't do it because of X, Y, and Z. And if you're following through, you should see results pretty quickly. You should see results within a couple weeks. And even if you start to see fasting blood glucose starts to get a little bit better, a postprandial blood glucose starts to get a little bit better, energy improves a little bit, maybe the weight's starting to come down appropriately. Like, if those things aren't happening, if say you're on this for like 3 weeks and then none of that has happened, like, then something seriously needs to change. So you should see it quick. Well, now say you want to lose 100 pounds. Is that going to happen in 1 month? No, that's going to take a couple months, but you should be seeing weight loss across that whole time frame. There shouldn't be this like, well, you have to wait like 4 years until all your poop was depleted and then you get a result. Like, that is not, that's gaslighting. that's not how this should run. I'm not even implying that Dr. Pete had said that, but that's something that gets thrown even inside the bioenergetics. You're like, you need to wait 4 years before your poop was depleted and you get any results. It's like, no, like, you should be getting results in the time frame of that 4 years that you are decreasing the total amount of poop on your body stores and not relying on that as the outcome. Like, you should be able, like, I've had clients within a couple months, within 6-7 months, lose massive amounts of weight, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 pounds. And the biggest difference is just how consistent can that person be in following through. That's it. Once you set it up, the person follows through, you see the result. If you don't get the result that you want, maybe it's 80% there, you make a change. So you keep what works and you shift what's not working. And you keep doing that, and eventually you find this spot where this is a nice little Goldilocks zone. But the person is losing their weight, they feel good, their symptoms are improved, their diet's working for them, they can implement it. And then it's like, now you're in the coast phase. It's like this nice, like, just continue with what you're doing and we'll make much more fine-tuned, small adjustments. We don't have to change so much things anymore. And then you also get to, like, if it's a weight loss, then you need to get back to maintenance when it's done. So you don't want to be in a deficit forever, obviously. So you get to your target weight and you come out. You come out of the deficit and you also are adjusting the deficit, because as you get leaner, it gets a little bit harder to maintain. Because as your body fat percentage drops, your body starts to realize that the bank account's getting low. Now, some things initially improve, of course, especially if you have a lot of body fat. But if you're already like for me, I'm pretty lean already. If I start to lose more body fat, I feel terrible because I'm already at the edge. Like, the bank account is already almost at zero. And so I'm getting notices that like the yearly fees are coming in because I'm not maintaining that balance.
You've obviously worked with a lot of people that are coming from the different dietary spheres, like low carb and bioenergetics. Something that I hear a lot from the bioenergetics crowd is, I added in carbs, my diet's, you know, organized, this and that, like, but I'm still not getting such and such results, like whether it's the blood sugar or losing the weight and stuff. So is there like maybe 1, 2, or 3 like most common mistakes that you see people make when they come into bioenergetics and start adding in bad carbs? Is it like keeping too much fat on board? Or like, what are the things that maybe somebody can start to think about today? Like, oh, maybe I am doing that and I can start to adjust these things.
I think the biggest one is like just adding carbs in and not looking at your total caloric intake and fat. That's the biggest one. And then, so that's number one. Number two is food sources. People are so restrictive in low carb, especially carnivore and keto stuff. And the OMAD, that when you like, now it's like Pandora's box is opened and I can have ice cream and I can have juice and sugar in my coffee and all this type of stuff. And then people go buck wild with it. And then they're not looking at their total intake. And then they cut, they're gaining weight and they're like, oh, it's the carbs. And it's like, I've had people, it's like, you're in a 500 to 1000 calorie surplus a day because your fat is still the same and you just threw carbs on top. The other thing is when you come out of these super restrictive paradigms, your appetite, especially if you've done it for a long time, is going to like be out of control. Like for me, it was uncontrollable when I came out of IF and keto. And then like the last one would be like having crap tons of dairy and maybe not doing super well with all the dairy. Those would be the big three. There's other things, but those are the big three that's like easy troubleshooting right off the bat. When somebody's like, we need to get your calories and macros dialed in, we need to stop the honey and granulated sugar and endless amounts of maple syrup and like use more reasonable carb sources. And we need to test your response to dairy. Big three immediately that I'm looking at for most people coming from those backgrounds.
And then if you're not doing the dairy, you can supplement the calcium because that's still one of the principles that you include in the diet.
Yeah, okay. Calcium and phosphorus is important.
Cool. I think we covered a lot there. There's a lot of things that people can look into after this podcast. And then, like I said in the beginning, we're looking to do the podcast maybe once a week or something like this. And we want feedback from the audience and them to participate and have some say in what topics that we discuss. So if there's anything that you want to see us talk about here, please leave them in the comments. And with that said, we'll see you maybe next week.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right.